comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth, thank you for being here. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you chose to be here, and I appreciate it. I'm here because you have a right to know, and because you matter. Tonight is K-Files night. You know what that is? Well, the K-Files is our free weekly newsletter. If you're not getting it, why not? It's free, and all you have to do is scoot over to my website, click that big link right in the middle of your screen that says K-Files, and subscribe. There's no genius in not getting it. And you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. But this is K-Files night. Friday night after the show, we begin sending out our weekly edition of the K-Files. If you subscribe and activate your subscription before the show is over, you will get this week's K-Files. If you don't, you will be in darkness yet another week. So you have a choice to make. Tomorrow night is our monthly chat. I do a chat in the chat room in our members community once a month. And so, you know, if you're a member, you don't have to wait to get an invitation. This is it. You're a member. You have a right to be there. We want you to be there. So you just log into the members community at showtime and then go to the chat room. Now, remember, when you join, you're supposed to read, and there's a big announcement in a yellow box right on the page after you log in that says, be sure you read the new member info. If you don't read that, you won't be able to do the chat. So one thing you got to get used to doing once you become a member is drive with your eyes open. I can put up the signpost, but you have to drive with your eyes open. You got to read the stuff. So be sure you read that new member info, okay? Now, if you're not a member, again, there's no genius in that. It's only 25 cents a day. That comes out to $7.50 a month. You can do it. And nobody but you can do it. All right? So click where it says join and become a member. I was the happy recipient today of a couple of new songs by a new band. This band has been together 2 months. This band is a couple of guys, 16-year-old, 17-year-old guys, and they are called East Iris. Well, you're going to get to hear them during a couple of the breaks tonight. You won't believe these are a couple of guys that are 16 and 17 years old. Absolutely phenomenal music. And I appreciate them for getting that music to me and for giving us the clearance to play it. I'm impressed by anyone who is good at anything. I'm more impressed when they're that young. All right, we are going to step away for a break, and we'll be back with Dr. Courtney Brown right after this. Well, that was them. That was East Iris. Can you believe that's a couple of guys 16, 17 years old? We got more from them. That's a band to watch. They've been together a couple of months. And that's also incredible that they could put something like that together in a couple of months. A lot different from the 16 and 17-year-olds doing bands when I was 16 or 17 years old. But, of course, back then, you know, we just clicked rocks together. it was a long time ago. My guest tonight is Dr. Courtney Brown. We are so delighted to have him back with us again this evening. And he is the director of Farsight Institute. The website is farsight.org. And if you are interested at all in what's coming, if you are interested at all in remote viewing, this is the guy you need to listen to. Dr. Courtney Brown, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we are delighted to have you with us once again.
Kevin, actually, it's my honor to be here. You're a really eloquent host, and I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience.
Courtney, before we get into what we're going to talk about tonight, let me ask you a question about the band that you just heard. Can you believe those guys are 16, 17 years old?
No, actually, when they started to play, you didn't let us know in advance that that was going to be them. You said that they were going to play sometime during the show, but you didn't let us know that that was it. And when I heard them, I said, wow, that's a really great song. I wonder if that's them. Nah, it couldn't be them. I'm waiting for two teeny boppers to show up. And then I said, I wonder, but he gave them such a good positive. I said, I wonder if it is. And then when you said that was it, that they were them, I said, wow, that is amazing. Now, Kevin, remember, one of the subjects I teach at Emory University, mostly I teach their math and statistics courses in the social science department, but one of the courses they allow me to teach that's not math and statistics is a course in political music. I'm an expert, believe it or not, in the political expression of political ideas musically, basically from the time of Beethoven up to the current time of hip-hop. Mm-hmm. So I'm really into quality music, and they were good, these two kids. I mean, they were really good.
Well, that's true, and they are, I think, headed for stardom. I really do. We have another one coming up later, and you'll know it immediately when you hear it. And I'll try to tell you if that's it, if I have time. But, you know, I don't always watch the clock. I'm an old guy, and I just sit here and things sneak up on me, you know.
Actually, I always consider age a function of how little people think. And in terms of that, you're one of the youngest people I've ever met.
Well,
you think
you.
A lot.
Yes.
People think a lot, and you've got a mind wide open and full of new ideas and uninhibited daring in terms of what you're willing to consider. And I know a lot of people who are chronologically a lot younger than you and intellectually a lot older and more rigid than you. So you're doing great.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Maybe that's why all my hair left. You know, it had to make room for the gray cells.
You've got nothing to complain about. I wear a bandana to keep my head warm because I've got none of it left.
I usually wear my hat, but my hat is AWOL tonight. I don't know where it is. folks that are watching just get to see my smiling face and shining bald head.
Actually, someone on one of, I think it was a YouTube video of mine made a comment where someone had made a comment about my bandana, and then somebody came in like an authority and say, oh, don't worry, everyone in their 50s goes through a midlife crisis and wears a bandana to cover their ponytail. He's got a ponytail. And then I read that and I said, gosh, I wish. I mean, believe me, if I had a ponytail, I wouldn't have a bandana. But this is very similar to the rock band U2, where there's Bono and The Edge. Remember Edge?
Yeah.
Well, Edge in the old days had a full frock of hair. And then that went. And at first he started to wear this really big, tall hat, and that was sort of awkward. So then he eventually put on this beanie cap that he wears. He never seen in public without it. And people just recognize it. That's just his look, and so they just assume that's it. But it keeps his head warm. And there's a lot of people, you know, 20 years old who have that bold look. So I call it a statement of fashion, Kevin. It's a statement of fashion.
Yeah. All right. Tonight, now, your previous appearances, we've touched on all of the four experiments that are in the DVD that is offered at Farsight. I believe it's at Farsight, isn't it?
Yeah, at the Institute, which is www.farsight.org, because we're a nonprofit. That's the org, O-R-G. And Farsight is F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T. Right on the homepage, there's a big link for the DVD, which is the Farsight Experiments. And the reason we put out that DVD, normally we put just everything up for free on the website, is people were, we're the only science shop around that has these enormous numbers of studies with all scientific controls. We're military-grade remote viewers, people who have practiced under strict guidance by former military remote viewers and great instructors like Glenn Wheaton of the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild, out of Special Forces Intelligence, and Lynn Buchanan out of Defense Intelligence Agency, teaching CRV, controlled remote viewing, where people like that have worked under them participate in scientific studies. And we interact with the public, and so that the public participate in our studies by watching it. We use encryption so people can hold the data and know that we don't cheat. And we have so much on our website that sometimes when people come to it, they begin to tell us that they're overwhelmed. There's just too much, because most websites are like brochures, but our website is like the Encyclopedia Britannica. I mean, it's just got so much stuff in it. And so we decided to come out with a DVD called The Farsight Experiments, which summarizes for the major projects that we've done and ties them all together, so people who want to know what we're doing and hit the ground running can just get the DVD, The Farsight Experiments. It's marketed, it's sold through Amazon. The links are on our homepage. And The Farsight Experiments has a number of projects in it and connecting a lot of stuff that connects the dots between them, so people get an idea of what we're all about. And one of the projects is about a planet that exploded between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter that we'll be talking about much tonight. And another other project we've actually talked about before, and that project is the project that's called the Multiple... Sorry for that bell. That will go off in a second, and I'll turn it off to make sure it doesn't happen again. No, that's the end of it. So that project is called the Multiple Universes Project, and one we've talked about before extensively with a full show was the project involving Mars, anomaly on Mars. And another project was the 2012 or post-2012 Earth changes. And we had a whole show on the post-2012 Earth changes. And remember that the post-2012 project, and all these projects are on the DVD and tied together nicely. The thing about the 2012 project is that when we covered it in the past, we were... There was one aspect that I didn't mention. And in retrospect, I thought that it would be really good if I did mention that aspect. So I'm wondering, Kevin, if it would be okay if I mentioned something about the 2012 project, meaning before we go into one of the new projects, such as the exploding planet, which is absolutely unbelievably riveting.
We can, and as a matter of fact, I now have some additional information I'm going to throw into the mix and see what you think about it. But we'll have to kind of hurry through it because we will be opening the phone lines in the second hour.
Sure. Well, do you want to start with some of the thing that you want to raise, or do you want me to go right into the update that I wanted to make?
No, do your update, and then I'll throw this into the mix.
Okay. Well, it's not an informational update. It's a contextual update.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, one of the things that we talked about in the 2012 Climate Project was that there were two timelines that we looked at. And for those of you who are new to this and didn't listen to some of the previous Kevin Smith shows, one of the shows is up on YouTube, and you can see it. And it involves all the basics behind the remote viewing phenomenon itself. I encourage you to look at that. But one of the things that we did with the 2012 project is we looked for change on the planet between June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013. Originally, we were expecting climate change, maybe an inch more of sea level rising, perhaps a little bit less snow on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. I wasn't taking the Mayan calendar thing seriously in the slightest. And this study was incredibly well structured from a scientific perspective with perfect randomization. All the viewers did everything totally blind. They didn't know the targets. They didn't know whether they were doing a 2008 or 2013 target. And we had two timelines we looked at for 2013. One, and remember also we talked about the idea that in the theory of remote viewing as it's being developed here, that there are multiple realities, multiple futures, multiple pasts, and that is something that evolves out of quantum mechanics, which is what I talked about before. And the question with the future is, which future are you going to be evolving into? And all of those futures actually simultaneously exist. And you experience one of them, but the other ones are just as real as the one you experience for reasons I explained previously. And one of the timelines we looked at was following the timeline in which, in 2013, the leadership of the mainstream global scientific establishment continues to ignore or deny both the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon and the existence of life not originating from Earth, even microbial life. And then the other timeline we looked at was following the timeline in which, by the end of 2009, leaders of the mainstream global scientific establishment publicly recognize the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon and the existence of life not originating from Earth. So 2009 already passed, so that's not our timeline. But the question is our timeline going to be more like the one in which the scientific establishment continues to ignore or deny the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon all the way up to June 1st, 2013? Or is it going to be more like the second timeline, where the scientific establishment eventually does publicly recognize the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon prior to June 1st, 2013, supposedly or hopefully like this year? And so I wanted to mention why I was looking at that. First of all, from a perspective of if the scientific establishment or leaders of the mainstream global scientific establishment recognize the reality of remote viewing, the idea would be that the planet would change immediately. We would all then, the whole planet, everyone would then start looking at the results of the remote viewing experiments that we've done and realize the complexity of life and maybe start acting towards the planet differently. So that was the idea behind thinking that climate change might be influenced by that. But when we found that the change that we were expecting, minor change, didn't happen, but in fact, to no one's greater surprise than myself, that the difference between 2008 and June 1st, 2013 included huge, unbelievably large Earth changes with tremendous things like tsunamis, solar radiation that was extremely high, most importantly, you would say, was the breakdown of the electrical system, so the electrical grid coming down for a long period of time. So basically you're talking about significant impacts in water, causing relocation away from coastal areas, and the breakdown of the governmental system and the vehicular transport system and the electrical grid. That's the electrical grid is the most important aspect of all of that. And so when we got those results, it became even more important that we looked at the two time streams involving the global scientific establishment. Because of the following, we're never expecting the government to proactively tell people about big changes that might be coming. And if you remember, Kevin, I did go through lots of anecdotal information that suggests that the governments are very aware of these potential changes for next year. And what we were expecting is that the mainstream scientific community would have a self-interest in talking about remote viewing prior to these changes. And this is what I forgot to mention or didn't mention, and I want to mention it now. And that is, if the results that we talked about for the post-2012 Earth changes do not occur, then the only thing that will happen is my reputation will take a bit of a dent, and I go back to the drawing board and try to figure out what went wrong and so on. But the theory is that small events don't affect many timelines, like what color shirt I'm wearing, but big events, such as something that would affect the entire planet, affect almost all timelines. And so it's very hard or almost impossible to predict small events in the future, but it is really easy to predict huge events that affect all timelines. This event, according to the theory I've developed, is of such magnitude that all events have to flow through it like a juggernaut. And so all timelines have to flow through it like a juggernaut. So if nothing happens, then my theory is wrong. However, based on all of the data and all of the theory that I've developed over the years, and which your listeners can see in the DVD, all put together nicely, the Farsight experiments, then I think I am right. And the right thing that I am about is that I'm expecting that these changes most likely will occur sometime after the end of this year.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back, I want to throw into the mix information that I got this week and see how that fits with what you saw, what your viewers saw. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Don't go away.
And you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to The Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, Dr. Courtney Brown. And we're talking about this 2012 project done by the Farsight Institute, of which he is director. And I said when we went away for break, I'm going to throw something into the mix when we come back and just see how it meshes with what Dr. Brown and his team saw in their experiments. This week, now this apparently has been going on longer than I was aware, because I just found out about it just a couple of days ago. But Russian cosmonauts have begun to talk about the extraterrestrial factors with space flight. They've begun to talk about the fact that there is contact and that there are several races involved, or species, or however you wish to refer to them. And in addition to that, the Russian cosmonauts working in concert with Russian scientists. Now, these scientists are very, very well-known scientists. One, I believe, received the Nobel Prize for some work in physics, are beginning to talk about what's coming. And one of the things that they say, now, I don't know if this is true, so folks, don't panic, okay? The link to a video about this with the Russian cosmonauts speaking will be in the K-Files. But they say that years ago there was a gigantic explosion in the center of our galaxy, and that there is a huge, gigantic wave of energy racing toward Earth. It is going to impact our solar system and our sun, causing the sun to move into its next phase, which is red giant. And that there will be tremendous earthquakes, and there will be tremendous tsunamis as a result of all of the impact, or the result of the impact of this wave on the sun and the sun's reaction to it. And they say this should happen about the 13th of December 2012. And they describe this as the point at which time is meeting itself, the beginning and the end meeting at the same point. And that there will be a split between timelines at that point. I think I'm accurately describing this. And so the Earth as it is will continue, but not as it is. It'll continue with great cataclysms. And then another timeline with no cataclysms. And your state of consciousness is going to determine which timeline you're in. So that's the information that I received this week. And I will tell you that as far as did these scientists, do they exist, that's been vetted, and the answer is yes. Are they saying these things? That's been vetted, and the answer is yes. That includes the scientists and those cosmonauts. So that's the information.
That's very interesting.
How does that fit in the mix with what your people saw?
Well, actually, that fits very well, except for the issue of a red giant. No one's expecting the sun to turn into a red giant, but to be active, much more active. Even NASA has been almost weekly declaring unprecedented solar activity of what they call Carrington-level events through much of 2013. And it's very difficult to imagine how they can predict the weather on the sun so many years in advance, especially when they're predicting unprecedented stuff. You can't really predict unprecedented stuff because you base your predictions of the future based on behaviors in the past, and unprecedented means it doesn't match behaviors in the past. And so they're clearly holding some information back that they know. And what you just described actually very closely matches my own conclusions in terms of the types of changes that we're going to be seeing. But there's one additional factor, and this is the thing I didn't get a chance to say before, and that is, Kevin, if these changes do occur, if they occur, which I think that will happen based on just my evaluation of the remote viewing data, then everybody on the planet will know that remote viewing is real. And now let me ask you, if scientists continue to refuse to ignore or deny the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon straight through next year, and then the events happen, and the entire world finds out that the remote viewing phenomenon is real and described this stuff correctly, what they're going to find out, what they're going to conclude is A, that the government's held information back from them and basically let them, you know, wing it on their own. But that's not going to be a surprise to people. But what they'll also recognize is that a great number of mainstream scientists, very high level, also held that information back and collaborated with the government, knowing that they would be put into safe places and things like that. And the problem with that is that I am a scientist also, and I really care about how the populace of the planet respects and really enjoys and values science. However, if it turns out that the scientists are perceived by the masses as duping the masses, withholding valuable information from the masses will then say, you lied to us. The government's lied to us, but we expected that. But now the scientists lied to us, and they will no longer believe the scientists. And when scientists try to come in later and say, now follow us, we know what to do, the masses very likely will turn away from them.
And or turn on them.
And that will raise the possibility that opportunists will come in to fill the gap. And those opportunists will come out of the woodwork and monopolize the attention of the masses for their own selfish needs. And that could raise the possibility of entering into a very dark age. I want to suggest that what we are tempting fate with is something similar to the French Revolution. Now, if you remember the French Revolution, well, maybe not personally, but, you know.
Oh, well, I was born, I think, just 2 days after that. But.
Well, you know, started in 1789, but soon after that, there was a period called the Reign of Terror. And the French Revolution didn't really end. Well, some people say it never ended. But it didn't really end until Napoleon took over in 1799. So they had an 11-year period there. But in the middle, there was the Reign of Terror. And the Reign of Terror, there was between 16,000 and 40,000 people killed, many of which, most of which, at least half of which, were guillotined. And what you had is that there was essentially a lack of leadership. People didn't trust the aristocracy. They were cutting the heads off the aristocracy. They didn't trust the nobility. They were cutting the heads off the nobility. They didn't trust any of the past leadership. And so what we're talking about is if these results actually come out to be, if and we're only some months away from finding out, then mainstream science is actually inviting a period of time in which they could lose control of the agenda, control of influencing the type of planet that we evolve into. Now, this actually addresses what you said in terms of the second timeline, when Earth basically splits and you have two different timelines, one which is goes very badly with cataclysms and a lot of negative stuff, and one in which a new Earth is born and not necessarily no cataclysms, but that the Earth changes and evolves into a what you might consider the Earth we always hoped for, where people no longer look at each other as potential sources of danger and hostility, polarized, but we look at each other as parts of the same universe and grow together, where we discover love is the driving force that drives the universe. And so what we're talking about is that the first negative realm, or the negative Earth that you just described, that would be combined with a period in which neither the governmental leadership nor the scientific establishment had the respect of the populace. And you're sort of tempting the idea of anarchy. And remember what stopped the anarchy of the French Revolution? Napoleon. Well, what if it wasn't Napoleon? What other types of examples do we have of people who came in and stopped anarchy? There's Hitler. There's Stalin. We're talking about things like that. So it's really in the interest of the mainstream scientific community, if these things are going to happen, that they simply fess up and talk about the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon. Because at that point, if the things do happen, then the masses will say, well, at least we weren't cheated by the scientific community. We can trust them. And I, as a scientist, would like to participate in that. Now, people have actually sometimes just recently come to me and said, but Courtney, even if the mainstream scientific community continues to ignore or deny the reality of remote viewing phenomenon, there's still you. You're telling the truth, and you told the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon, so you can lead. And I say, I would be the smallest voice in a cacophony of noise. How could I hold the attention of the masses when so much anger is released because of such devastating changes coming about with the full knowledge that the mainstream scientific community held information back from them? How can I do that? So I would have no power to do that. So the reality is that the mainstream scientific community really has it in their best interest to talk about the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon, because if these events do occur, now if they don't occur, the only damage is to my own reputation. But if they do occur, then if the mainstream scientific community does talk about remote viewing, the ability to direct the future evolution of humanity towards a better Earth is so much greater, enhanced, because we don't lose the credibility of the mainstream scientific community. And then I can participate in that fully as a member of the scientific community. And that's what I forgot to mention later, that how crucial it is that the scientific community, or at least members of the mainstream scientific community, drop the fear of being honest about these new areas of research, such as the mainstream, such as the remote viewing phenomenon. Remember, we will know in just a few months. If the events are going to occur, they're going to occur. And if they occur, the whole game is over. And my theory is that these events seem to be of such large magnitude that it is most likely a future that you can predict, because all timelines have to go through it.
All right. We have to go through this upcoming break. And when we come back, we need to get to that exploded planet project, because we're only 15 minutes away from our second hour. Ladies and gentlemen, we are talking to Dr. Courtney Brown this evening. He is the founder and director of the Farsight Institute. The Farsight Institute website is Farsight, FARSIGHT.org. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Dr. Courtney Brown. And Dr. Brown is the director of the Farsight Institute. We've been talking about the 2012 project, but we're going to move to the Exploded Planet project. And I think a lot of you are familiar with the Exploded Planet theory, probably through the work of Dr. Thomas Van Flandren. But the Farsight Institute took a look at this, and Courtney, let's get a thumbnail sketch of that. What are we talking about here?
Okay, well, the mainstream astronomical community believes that the asteroid belt is a byproduct of the creation of the original solar system, out of the solar nebula, the gases and dusts that were forming and condensing to form the planets and the sun. There was some junk left over, and that junk created the asteroid belt. However, there are some astronomers that think that's ridiculous. And this was originally raised by an astronomer long ago named Heinrich Olbers, who he actually discovered one of the asteroids originally, one of the first discoveries of the asteroids, and he suggested that this looks like there should be a planet in that area, and it's not there. There must have been one that exploded. Now, the trouble is that way back when, in the 1800s, Louis Lagrange was a mathematician, and he was more, he was more famous, more respected. He had a bigger name. And he claimed that the comets were further evidence of this exploding planet. The trouble was that there was yet even a bigger name that came around, and that was Marquis de Laplace. And he basically refuted the whole thing and said, this is ridiculous, there's no exploding planet. And he said the solar nebula idea was really the thing. Well, mainstream astronomers, ever since Laplace, gripped the solar nebula idea because they didn't like to think that a planet could explode. First of all, they didn't know what could cause a planet to explode. And secondly, it made it very uncomfortable to think that a planet could explode because we happen to live on a planet. But the reality is they've never seen anything explode. You can say, well, they've seen supernovas. When I say, well, you know, you never know. There's been no space probe out there that took a close-up photo to see whether it was a planet around a star that exploded or whether it was the star that exploded. They just assume that it was the star that explodes in a supernova. They never actually know. So the idea was that Thomas Van Flandern, the late Thomas Van Flandern, he was a very mainstream astronomer, and he collected an enormous body of planetary data supporting the idea that a planet between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter exploded. And it was widely scoffed at by the other mainstream astronomers, but if you look at the data, it's really incontrovertible. It's very clear that his data really are well supported, and it's almost a theological proposition that the other astronomers are holding to suggest that it was just a solar nebula hypothesis, given the data and the evidence that it was there. But nonetheless, we do remote viewing, a mental procedure that allows highly trained individuals, basically that have studied the military or military-derived procedures under strict guidance for a decade or more, to describe places and events across time and space. I developed a project that looked at whatever caused the asteroid belt and to see what it was. Was it the solar nebula that those asteroids sort of condensed out of? And secondly, could it possibly have been a planet? Now, the solar nebula idea has a couple real bad problems. The first is that those asteroids are rocks, really heavy rocks. And you need a gravity source to pull the matter for those rocks together to produce such highly compressed asteroids. Those aren't just like some dust. Those aren't just like pools of dust that are loosely gripped. Those are really solid rocks. So you had really tremendous pressure putting that mass together. And secondly, a lot of the asteroids have very distinct marks of having been burned, exposed to a great deal of heat. Thirdly, the asteroids themselves, if you took them all and added them all up, you don't have enough mass to form an entire planet. So that means the explosion, if it did happen, it had to be sufficiently large to eject most of the mass of the planet outside the solar system or outside the asteroid belt, leaving what's left of the planet inside the thing. So, in a nutshell, the evidence that the planet exploded is actually in the actual nature of the asteroids themselves, especially the high temperature searing that's on the surface of the asteroids. We also have an idea of when the asteroid, when the planet exploded. It exploded approximately 3 million years ago. Now, how do we know that? because, and this is coming from Thomas Van Flandern's work, because the comets, many of the comets are brand new, meaning it's the first time they're entering the inner realm of the solar system. And a lot of them have water with salt in it, suggesting it was a salt water place that they started from. That would be a planet, of course. And the comets that are coming in brand new to the system have a 3 million year orbit. That means they were first ejected from the inner realms of the solar system 3 million years ago and are now returning. Similarly, there's meteors, which is a lot of junk up there, as being only, a lot of meteors give evidence of being only 3 million years old.
Okay,
and
so I got a question there. Are the meteors
from the exploding planet as well?
Okay, are the meteors and the asteroids part of the same exploded planet?
Meteors are smaller pieces of junk, and they happen to be having more wide orbits, but they are from the same stuff. Also, at about that time, we did have planetary concussions here on Earth, meaning things hit us. And in addition, it does appear that Mars was very close to the planet that exploded. In fact, part of the theory is Mars may have been orbiting the planet that exploded, because half of Mars is very heavily cratered, and the crust of the cratered side is actually much thicker by a few kilometers than the other side. That means that half of Mars was really hit hard by the exploding debris. Now, if that's not enough, there is a very interesting phenomenon with Iapetus. Iapetus is a satellite that orbits Saturn, and it's a white icy moon that's tidally locked in the orbit around Saturn. And what that means is that it's like our moon, the same face of Iapetus constantly faces Saturn. So what apparently happened that Tom Van Vlandern pointed out is that when this planet exploded with tremendous force, it sent a debris wave throughout the solar system. And the debris wave eventually hit Iapetus. Now, Iapetus was white, icy, and because it was tidally locked, it held steady. It didn't have an atmosphere, so it held steady while the debris wave hit it. And what you see on the side of Iapetus is the result of an impact of a debris wave. It looks just like almost like gunpowder that was, or something that was actually smacked on it. In fact, you know what I'm going to do for those members of the Kevin Smith Show that are actually watching this. I'm going to show a picture on the video, and so you can also see it, Kevin, of Iapetus. Can you see that now?
Yes.
Okay. So if you see it, and I'll describe it so that those people who are listening by radio can see it, can picture it in their mind. Iapetus is here seen as a white icy moon, and on the right-hand side of Iapetus, of this picture, and this is a picture that was obtained by NASA, of course, in the Cassini space probe, there's a dark black splotch on the side of Iapetus, where it's very clear a debris wave hit it. Now, originally, the mainstream scientific community wanting to do whatever they could to get away from the idea of exploding.
We have to take a break. We will be back, folks, right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dr. Courtney Brown. Those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, oh my, welcome aboard and my sympathy to you for what you have missed. My best thoughts and prayers for you so that you never miss a first hour of the Kevin Smith Show again. Dr. Courtney Brown, oh, by the way, the music you just heard is the other song I was telling you about by East Iris. Aren't they great? Dr. Courtney Brown is talking with us about the exploded planet theory and the project that Farsight Institute, the Remote Viewing Institute, that he is the founder and director of. So he's talking about the project that they did looking at this exploded planet. And we will be opening the telephone lines here in about 10 or 15 minutes. So get your fingers ready to do the dialing. And Dr. Brown, if you will, go ahead with what you were telling us about Iapetus.
Yeah, the satellite of Saturn, a white icy moon, apparently was hit by a debris wave from that exploding planet that was raised and pointed out by Thomas Van Flandern, the late astronomer. He was also head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics at the Naval Observatory. He was very mainstream. And scientists, other astronomers, wanting to avoid the idea that a planet could explode, originally theorized that this dark matter that's on one side of Iapetus, it looks like a splotch on the side of it. And those of you who are in the Kevin Smith member room, you can actually see the picture I'm projecting now. Scientists originally said this is dark matter that's sublimating up from within Iapetus to the surface. But that doesn't look like that at all. It looks like it was hit by a splotch. It's a splotch because it was hit by something. So that was really a hard sell. But they pushed it for a long while.
Well, you can actually see the splatter pattern.
Yeah, you can see the splatter pattern. It's so obvious. Anyway, they knew it was a hard sell, but they kept pushing it. And then somebody else in the mainstream scientific astronomical community said, oh, I have a better idea. And they said that there is another moon of Saturn that is dipping in and out of a previously hidden ring system, and over the millions of years, gently depositing a stream of debris exactly on that spot in Iapetus. And then quickly the astronomical community dropped the sublimating from within Iapetus up and said, yes, this must be. But even that is sort of, I mean, talk about fairy tales. I mean, the idea of exactly hitting Iapetus on one spot over millions of years with this other thing. Anyway, so the reality is there was a debris wave, and it's really interesting to see the comical dances that the astronomical community does to avoid the obvious truth that there was a debris wave that hit Iapetus. And so the real question that they really want to avoid is what could cause a planet to explode. And I actually have some ideas on that, which is sort of chilling, but I nonetheless have some ideas on that. But as you can see from the photo, and as I've described the photo, that the evidence, and I've just covered a small fraction of the evidence that was raised, that was collected by Thomas Van Flandern in support of the exploding planet hypothesis, a planet that once existed between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. It was such a tempting thing for me to say, let's do a full study of this using remote viewing and simply posit the two hypotheses of whether the asteroid belt came from refuse or junk that was left over from the primordial solar nebula that most mainstream astronomers suggest, or whether it came from a planet that once exploded. So we did a study using the best military-grade remote viewers on the planet Earth. People who had studied and practiced remote viewing had a huge track record, public track record, for accuracy in remote viewing. Many of their sessions are available on the Institute's website and are described in detail, in fact, in the DVD, the Farsight Experiments, and the many projects that are on that DVD. And under totally blind conditions, I tasked the exploding planet hypotheses. Actually, I tasked three different targets to these viewers that would tell us the story about what caused the asteroids. Two of the targets were actual asteroids. I picked two asteroids. One was basically a carbon-based asteroid, and the other was a silicate-based asteroid. The S-type asteroid, or silicate-based asteroid, was called 433 Eros, and the target was the creation of that. And the other one was 253 Mathilda, and that was a C-type, a very dark or carbonaceous, carbon-based asteroid. Thomas Van Flandern had also hypothesized that there might have actually been two planets, one more Earth-sized and one more like a gas giant that had exploded. The gas giant would have exploded in the much distant past, but the Earth-sized one around 3 million years ago. And that is why there's two separate bands within the asteroid belt, one with carbonaceous type asteroids and the others with silicate. But basically we were just looking at those two asteroids and saying what caused them. So the target was the origin of those two asteroids. And the third target was the event or process that created the dark patch on the side of Iapetus, beginning with the initiation of the event or the process. And to cut to the chase, the resulting remote viewing data offered close to zero support for the gradualism or solar nebula hypothesis. There was just no support for that. But unbelievably, slam dunk, total support for the exploding planet or catastrophism hypothesis, meaning the remote viewing data. And now remember, these remote viewers are the best on the planet. So when they do sessions, we're not talking about sessions that are really hard to interpret. We're talking about sessions that are really easy to interpret because these data are really good. And I'll give you an example that we can actually look at and then describe for your radio listeners. And here is a picture of a session done by Dick Allgaier, who actually is a celebrity newscaster in Hawaii, and probably one of the very absolute best, maybe the best remote viewer in the planet. And he works with Glenn Wheaton out of Special Forces Intelligence. And as you can see, this is a picture that he did for the origin of Eros. Well, there's not much ambiguity about that. He clearly found a planet that was cracking up. Now, this is just one image from a longer session that described the whole exploding, that described the whole exploding planet. But from this one picture, you can actually see the planet exploding, the energy coming out of it, and it's really clear that these people were talking about an exploding planet. Other sessions, similarly, using different methodologies, came up with the same type of thing. I'll give you an example here of a session that was done by Daz Smith using the CRV methodology. He works with Lynn Buchanan. And so here we go. You can see now this other session, and this is the origin of Eros. So different people using different military-derived methodologies coming up with the same results. This is the origin of Eros. You have an explosion. And he actually writes. He actually draws the explosion with the debris wave expanding outward. And then he has the feel of an explosion. He writes that. Forced movement outwards in all directions. So it's really clear that the remote viewing data did support the idea of the exploding planet. Now, before we get to the phone lines, I want to say something that I have never said before. And that's because it wasn't directly included in the remote viewing study as part of the project. And that is the cause of the exploding planet. What would actually cause a planet to explode? And one of the things that you have to understand is that there's a great deal of information that either has been kept from us or we don't know. But my based on information I have, and I'm really not ready to explain where I get this information yet. I normally wait until all the, until I have sort of separate studies on all of this information. But it appears as if my best guess for what actually happened is that this was an Earth-sized planet 3 million years ago, and it had exploded as a result of warfare. And my, again, I will eventually get to a full study where I will test this and show it, but I'm almost positive that based on what I've seen so far, that what basically happened is that it was not an interplanetary war, it was a war with on the planet. And that there were two sides, and that they had developed large nuclear weapons that were bigger than the ones that we have. And what appears to have occurred is that one side had a large stockpile of these extremely large nuclear weapons that were much larger than ours. They apparently may have actually used some nuclear weaponry on each other from time to time. But what looks like might have happened is that one side launched a missile of one of these very powerful weapons on a stockpile of these other weapons, of the similar large nuclear weapons that the other side had, hoping to knock it out. And
it did.
It got through. Mm. And not only did it blow itself up, but it ignited all of the other similar weapons that were housed in that site, and the planet cracked. I have some remote viewing evidence for this. I have other evidence, other indications that this is what happened. Again, I will eventually get to a full study that will focus on the cause. Now that we know that the asteroid belt was caused by an exploding planet, now it's appropriate for me to then target the cause of the explosion. And where this is where I can actually sort this out exactly. But based on what I've seen so far, I do think that this was an inhabited planet and it was an act of war. I do not think that it was an act of war between Mars and that planet. Mars was an inhabited planet at that time, and it was severely devastated by the explosion, but it didn't kill off all the life on Mars. It was a really bad day. Half of Mars was was destroyed, but it didn't knock the atmosphere off Mars, and Mars still was warm, and it still had a lot of water. What killed off Mars, the final thing that killed off Mars so that it is what it is today, happened apparently about 1 million years ago, which was 2 million years after the planet exploded. That planet, by the way, we call Maldek, M-A-L-D-E-K. And what happened was there was an explosion on the surface of Mars that was a nuclear explosion. Now I'm going to show you one more screen, and this is going to be of a book. And this book, you should be able to see it now, is a book by John Brandenburg, a very mainstream guy, and it's called Life and Death on Mars. And in that book, it just was published last year, he details the planetary data for Mars, including a very detailed description of the nuclear radioactive isotope data for Mars. And indicating that there was a unambiguous nuclear explosion on the surface of Mars in the Mare Acidelium region, where there's a surface crater. Now, we do know of processes where nuclear reactions can occur naturally underground, deep underground. In South Africa, for example, there are concentrations of uranium that are sufficiently concentrated that they're hot. So on a theoretical level, underground, deep underground, with sufficient pressure and so on, it is possible for uranium to form naturally such that it can g- get hot and potentially have a nuclear reaction. However, we know of no possible ways that that could happen naturally above ground. And the nuclear explosion that occurred on the surface of Mars 1 million years ago in the Mare Acidelium region caused a scarring. The radioactive isotope data are very clear for that particular region. And the traces, the radioactive isotope traces very clearly indicate a nuclear explosion. And there's also a very shallow crater indicating that the explosion was on the surface of Mars. That's what killed off the last of the atmosphere of Mars, meaning Mars was still inhabitable, even if it was an unhappy place to inhabit because of what happened 2 million years ago, 2 million years before that, when the planet Maldek exploded. It was nonetheless capable of still housing life. But after that nuclear explosion occurred on the surface of Mars, that was the end of that. It blew the rest of the atmosphere away, or, you know, enough of the atmosphere. So actually there is probably still life on Mars, but it's under very strained conditions.
All right, let's invite the audience to join us. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to join us, and I hope you do, the way you do it is pick up your telephone and enter this magic combination of numbers. And here it is, 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. If you are in the USA or if you're in Canada, please use that telephone number. If you are outside of the USA and outside of Canada, you may use that telephone number, or there is an additional option for you, and that is go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and right above the picture is a link that says Flash Message. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Steve from Georgia.
Okay, Steve.
This is really uncanny, Kevin. I want to refer to your spot in the K-Files that you mentioned about the cosmonauts and the Russian scientists talking about the Earth changes that are coming, mm-hmm. and the Earth will kind of move into two different dimensions, one very cataclysmic and rough, and the other into a higher world. I have been shown that same thing, though I've never been given a date. You know, they said December 13th. And Kevin, from the time I started getting realizations, waking up to the fact of our being multidimensional, you know, and actually having these experiences myself, mm-hmm. this is part of the information that came through with that awakening, is that the Earth is approaching a kind of a period of decision, shall we say, you know, and people are going to be caught on one side of it or the other. And I would also like to point out to the powers that be or their lackeys that may be listening, if you're stuck on the cataclysmic Earth, there will really be no safe place for you. You know, I mean, they've got Bechtel Corporation digging these huge underground bases. They think they're going to be safe. They think they'll be able to come up when it's all over, and it's just not so. You know, they're not safe. There will be no safe place for them. The only safe place is in the heart and mind of someone who's waking up, you know, someone who is ridding themselves of the fear-based programming that they try to keep us bogged down and held down into the mental prison they're building us. And, you know, it's it would be a shame to get caught on the wrong side of that change. You know, I hate it for people that are going to be stuck. But Kevin, I've been shown the same thing, and it just blew my mind, you know, when you mentioned that the cosmonauts and scientists in Russia are mm-hmm. talking about this.
Well, they certainly are, and they're writing about it. And they say the reason they haven't spoken about it until now is they most of them have family and they have children, and they were told if you don't if you talk about it, your children will die. And so for years they kept quiet, but now apparently, unofficially, they have been told it's so close, go ahead.
All right, I definitely resonate with that, Kevin. That's right on. And you know, I hate it for the scientists who have allowed the argument to be taken from them, you know, in the name of political correctness, in the name of holding on to tenure and government grants. You know, I hate it for them because they're going to get stuck on the wrong side of an argument.
Well, one world is going to be populated by kangaroos. And that, you know, if this all pans out, and I'm not saying that I even think it will, but if it all pans out like the Russian scientists and cosmonauts are saying, one planet will be populated by kangaroos. And what I mean by that is we do have a planet full of people who may as well believe they are kangaroos because they have been convinced that they are human when they are not. They are above that. There were humans. They're gone. Now, I see Dr. Brown looking up, and he's like, oh, my God, what have I stepped into here? But, you know, Steve, I don't know if you have read my book, Gods in the Garden, but that book deals with the fact that we are, whoever El is, Elohim is the plural, and whoever El may be, we are genetically, biologically related to El, if Genesis is true. That isn't something you'll learn at church, but it is what's written in there. And the reason Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden was not because they sinned and fell from grace. It says right in Genesis why. Because now the man has become one of us. And we don't want him to reach his hand into the DNA secret, so he's got to leave here. And it says that in Genesis.
Yep.
And so those who are convinced they are human, I guess, get to stay on the human timeline, which is cataclysmic. And those who understand that that's not what we are, we're above that. We are Elohim. Three different places it says that we are Elohim.
Right.
So if it's true, and maybe I'm wrong, but if it's true, then believing you're human is about equivalent to believing you're a kangaroo.
And
we got caught by a break. Hang on. We'll be back, folks, right after this.
But nothing's hotter than the Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Courtney Brown, and on the telephone with us, Steve. Steve, did you have a question or a comment for Dr. Brown?
Well, I'm just wondering if Dr. Brown is acquainted with the work of Paul LaViolette and his subquantum kinetics, the work that he's done on that. That and maybe a second part to the question. Our plasma core of the Earth you know, absorbs plasma from the sun, or energy, radiant energy from the sun. And and of course, this weekend we're supposed to have a huge X-class flare come straight at us. And you know, NOAA and the National Weather Service are in, and, or rather NASA, NOAA and NASA are in disagreement over the severity of the result of this thing. And I'm wondering if he has thought about the plasma core of the Earth absorbing so much energy that it would want to explode, or it would escape, throw off some of its energy through volcanism and natatural disasters. And I'll take his answer off the phone.
Okay.
Thank you. I've eaten up enough time.
Thanks for the call.
That's actually a really interesting question. The core of the planet, however, is molten iron, and what is so crucial about that swirling liquid iron core is that it is that it causes our magnetic fields to actually occur, magnetic north. And what's been happening over the last couple decades is that the magnetic north has been hiking. It's been really moving fast. It's moving now at a rate of 40 kilometers a year. And it used to be in the 1970s and 80s in the middle of Canada. And it's now really close to the actual true north of the planet. And the theory is that when it gets close to the true north, it will flip. Now, it won't flip 180 degrees, but it most likely will flip to be located someplace in Siberia, for example. But it'll be somewhere else. And the movement that's occurred so far, and this is all due to the stuff that's going on in the inner Earth, the molten iron core, is so severe that the airplane runways are labeled by what direction, magnetic direction they point. They're having to be repainted because they're no longer pointing in the right direction. And so they're being given different numbers. So a runway that may be 260, meaning it's pointing in the direction of 260 degrees, is now pointing in a different direction because magnetic north has moved. Well, when the magnetic pole flips, there'll be a short period of time of some days when there will essentially be no magnetic shield on the Earth. And what will happen then is that radiation that is coming from the sun, as well as radiation that is coming from the center of the galaxy that Kevin talked about earlier in the show, will have a free rein to enter into the Earth. And when that happens, that radiation will mix its energy. It's essentially light energy. And when it comes, it will be able to mix with the energy that composes us. And the theory is that when the different energies mix, they have an influence on one another, and we will shift in our, what we might call our quantum signature, or our average quantum vibration, to a higher frequency. And the reason it would be higher is because the energy that would be coming in would be higher than the dominant quantum frequency that dominates us now. It would be above the visible light spectrum. It would be in the, for example, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. It would be higher than that. So you add higher frequencies to our overall mix that make up our quantum stuff, then we would vibrate at a slightly higher frequency.
Okay, so what would prevent that energy from just disintegrating us?
Well, it's because that wouldn't lead to an explosion. What that would lead to is a vibrational shift.
No, I mean, you know, our flesh. What would keep it from just disintegrating our flesh? Because a microwave would not be at that high an energy level, and a microwave will bake you.
Yeah, actually, the electromagnetic spectrum for microwaves is actually below the visible light spectrum. I talked about this in an earlier show where we essentially, this is borrowing from a quantum mechanics theory developed by Hugh Everett, starting in his dissertation in 1957, where the generalization of quantum mechanics is envisioned so that all things are energy, and that the energy that the physicists look at in terms of quantum mechanics, or very small things, is simply aggregated up to larger things so that we ourselves are essentially parallel to quantum things, and we have a wave function. The planet has a wave function. The universe has a wave function. And these wave functions are the result of the mix of frequencies that come together to produce us. And when you add new frequencies to us, you're actually adding a new ingredient to a cake you're making. And so that doesn't cause the cake to explode. If you add lemon juice to a cake mix, you'll have a cake, and it'll still look like a cake, but it'll be a lemon-flavored cake. And so if you add higher frequencies to us, it will raise the overall average of our vibrational quantum signature, and we will be vibrating differently. It doesn't make us disintegrate or explode, but we do vibrate differently. Kevin, there's one thing I want to emphasize here. There's a reason why I wanted to talk about the exploding planet idea, the planet that exploded between Mars and Jupiter, because I know everyone's interest is really on the post-2012 changes. We've already talked about that, but the reason I wanted to focus on the exploding planet, we've basically done that, so we can move on, but is because it's a clear example of two different theories that focus on mainstream science. And that is, the first one is uniformitarianism or gradualism. And basically that is a theory that all things change gradually, like the grass growing. And if you look at a solar nebula, for example, you say all those gases out there, and you see mainstream astronomers saying how those gases gently collapse into forming suns and planets and how nice everything is, la-di-da. But uniformitarianism or gradualism, which is really embraced by mainstream science, is different from catastrophism. And catastrophism says that all processes that occur start with a bifurcation point, and that bifurcation point stops whatever the process was before it. It's a violent ending of that process, and it starts a new process. Now, that process then starts with the period of heavy growth with positive feedback, leading to slower growth or negative feedback, and then leveling off to a constant steady state or perhaps a periodic limit cycle, but it levels off to something. And the idea with catastrophism is like a bookend that starts and stops a process. In between those bookends, you have a continuous process that looks like uniformitarianism or looks like gradualism, but it's not, because the bookends are really violent disruptions of that process. So mainstream science likes to think that everything is permanently uniformitarianism, gradualism constantly. But catastrophism says that these gradual processes are just an illusion. We really do have radical departures from past systems, and sometimes those radical departures are really quite violent. And so the reason why I wanted to talk about the exploding planet hypothesis is to give an example in both the case of Mars and Maldek, the planet that exploded, of catastrophism being a normal phase of our existence. And so what we're actually coming to in the post-2012 period, if the remote viewing data are correct, is an example of catastrophism. Now, with catastrophism, it doesn't mean that everything ends. It's not the end of the Earth. But it's the end of a process that used to exist prior to that period. And it's the beginning of a new process that then grows fast and then slowing off to level state that is a different. And so what you're talking about with what the cosmonauts were talking about is saying that in this period beginning around December of this year, you're talking about the beginning of a brand new process, but that implies the ending of an old process. That's catastrophism. And if a planet can explode in the middle of our own solar system, then we should accept the idea that catastrophism is, in fact, a very real aspect of our existence, and gradualism or uniformitarianism is not everything. People would like to say everything's just continual and a slow process of change. That's just not what happens. Change happens gradually, but it's punctuated by radical departures. And those radical departures are when the old system ends and a new system starts. And that's what we're apparently heading towards in just a few months. And Kevin, if we do have a new system that starts up in just a few months in the post-2012 period, that's what I was saying. It's so crucial that mainstream scientists weigh in now and acknowledge the reality of remote viewing, because if a new system does start, they will lose the ear of the masses if they do not acknowledge the reality of remote viewing prior to the beginning of that new system. And that's what we should really try to avoid, because that allows us to create a better Earth, a better society, a humanity that we would really like to say is an example of the best life can create in our galaxy. That's what we really want to shoot for.
Well, how do you shoot for that? I mean, look, it can't be just that the scientists are really smart, which they are, and that they decide to tell us the truth. Because, I mean, let me set up a straw man here. Hermann Goering was a really smart guy in some respects. And there were times when he told the truth. There were times when he lied, but there were times when he told the truth. Would we now, today, trust him simply because he could point back and say, well, I told you the truth about this, I told you the truth about that? Because we can see science as a whole really has become more of a religion than it has anything to do with actual science. They hold on to theories that they can't prove and defend them as if they were religious dogma and enforce them as if they were religious dogma. You know, they told us, I can remember when I was in high school being told that there is no evidence that there's any other solar system out there. There's no other place where there are planets around stars.
Actually, Kevin, if I can interject, that was the absolute bottom line and religiously enforced in classes all up until 1995. That's how recent.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, this is fresh in our minds, and now, you know, there's this whole thing about vaccinations, you know. And, well, you know, all these scientists say, well, we need all these vaccinations to save lives. And then there are a bunch of other scientists saying, hold on just a minute, those vaccinations will kill you. And so the public's caught in the middle. And then the government says, oh, no, they won't kill you, and you're a terrorist if you say so. And then a bunch of kids overseas die from these things. And, you know, I don't think science has a lot of footing they can return to. We have to take a break, and we'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach. We only have a couple of minutes left here before we hit the end of the show, and we do have a caller on hold. I think we'll just go ahead and jump over to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's John from Vancouver, Iowa.
Hello, John.
Hi. I just want to confirm your thing about El and Elohim.
No.
Pardon me?
We can't get too involved with that, because that's not what the show is about.
Is to stitch some of this together, as far as my understanding goes.
Okay.
Okay. So, So as far as Dr. Brown is concerned, the two planetary explosions were actually decisions made by the inhabitants of those planets. You know, they went to war and decided to go for it. Which does with your notion of L, because if you know, those of us who are L decide to blow a planet up, we can do that. And what Dr. Brown is saying is that actually happened in the past with two planets. One is gone and the other is a dead planet called Mars.
Yeah. The actual existence of life on this planet is not only in the hands of the cosmos, but it's in our hands as well.
Well, that's what I'm trying to confirm along your lines.
Mm-hmm.
It is in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
And if previous planets were blown up by the inhabitants, it was in their hands.
Yeah.
And that's a choice made, not in the best choice, in my opinion, but it was a choice made.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And they probably had elections, too.
Okay, so let's review elections then, perhaps. Maybe there's another way.
You know, unfortunately, we have a really nasty habit all over this world of putting the very worst of us in charge. And we have a history of that. It's not always the case. Sometimes we do put someone in charge who really has the best interest of the people at heart. It's a rare thing. But sometimes we luck out. Usually we put people in charge that, from my point of view, are insane. But, John, thanks so much for the call.
You know, maybe we elected the wrong person, but, like, wouldn't we put a stop to that?
Well, we don't seem to. An incumbent, no matter how bad he is, has a 98% chance of being reelected. So, historically. John, I'm going to move along just in case somebody else wants to give us a quick call. But thank you. Very good thoughts. Now, I thought John was going to sort of get into the whole thing about Genesis. And that's not what we're here about tonight. I just threw that in as an example. But, you know, I was saying, Doctor, that I'm not real sure that science has much footing at this point. They could recover some if they come clean. But we have one more call. Caller, you are live.
Kevin, that's actually a good point. You're actually raising the very point I was pointing in the first place. When you say that science has, you know, already a credibility problem, that's exactly what I'm pointing to. And if these changes actually do occur, and we're only months away from finding out, that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
People will then say, the debate will be over, and it will be too late. And then science is going to be in a situation of saying, oh, but listen to me now, that was just a mistake we made, and we can do it right now. And if it was not really major earth changes, but rather just something stupid or something silly, people might give them a second chance. But when people are really facing dramatic confrontations with physical survival, then you know they're not going to look at science and say, okay, you lied to us once, so it'll be all right. They're going to look at science and say, you lied to us once, you're in cohorts with the people who are keeping information from us, and it will simply be difficult for science to get the attention and the respect that I believe it really does need.
I think I'm going beyond that.
A scientist in the future, and I do not want to see our society degrade, devolve into a society that believes in snake oil charmers.
Yeah.
I want to take the science that we've got and make it better.
We got one more call we got to take. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Kevin from Sacramento.
Hello, Kevin. Go ahead.
I was just wondering if you guys heard anything about military issuing warnings about a large planetoid headed towards Earth.
I read something about it today, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to... Well, I haven't had a chance to vet that information to find out how accurate it is. But, yeah, I read about that today.
Yeah, me either. And I was wondering if you had that answers my question.
Okay, well, let's see what Dr. Brown... Do you know anything about
like
that, Dr. Brown?
Legitimate source.
No,
that guy was in
brand
the military,
new.
So...
Yeah, I read it. It's on the Internet, so it's automatically way over on my weirdometer.
Yeah.
And it has to be vetted before I can say, this has some traction. The information I gave earlier about that giant energy wave headed this way, I can't prove that that's the case, but do these scientists to whom those statements are attributed exist? And I vetted that. Yes, they do. Are they saying these things? I vetted that. And yes, they are.
And it would actually match with the data that we're actually getting, the remote viewing data. There is actually a connection there. You know, Kevin, I might mention something. We've talked about the projects that I've done in the past, that we've done here at the Farsight Institute in the past. But I've not yet mentioned one that's on the front burner, one that we just finished the remote viewing for, and I'm now working on the video production for it to sort of present it.
Okay, we got about a minute, so you'll have to make it quick.
Okay, well, the basic bottom line is, not only are we talking about major changes that have happened in our solar system and major changes that may be happening on Earth, mm-hmm. but you will see over the next few months, we are going to present information that will clearly indicate and clearly show, both with physical data as well as remote viewing data, that we once had a civilization on Earth, we, not extraterrestrials, us, that... was a little bit more technologically advanced than we are now and died out entirely 70,000 years ago. Only 2,000 people survived, and scientists, that's not in dispute. They call it the result of the Toba incident, which they think was a volcano that went off. But it was basically an energy device that was developed. Think of Fukushima times 85, and it blew up. It got out of control. And it blew a hole in the side of the Earth the size of Australia.
Okay, you got 20 seconds.
And that's what we're going to be getting towards in a few months.
Outstanding. Will you come back and talk with us about that one?
Absolutely. That's going to be one of the most exciting projects we've ever done. And the remote viewing is over on that, so I know the results, but I have to put it together and present it.
All right. Dr. Brown, if you'll stay on the line with me for just a moment as we bring this in for a landing. That's it, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Courtney Brown. And I hope you have one fantastic weekend. We have a great week lined up for you here at the Kevin Smith Show for next week. And don't forget, we have the chat in our chat room, in the members community, Saturday night at Showtime. So if you're not yet a member, join. As soon as you join, you read that new member info in the members community, and you'll be ready to rock and roll. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.